The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Hi folks, good Shabbos. We're gonna start off with a little game. In just a second, I'm gonna ask everybody to close their eyes. And I'm gonna read off a quote that was either said by a famous anarchist thinker or a famous Marxist thinker. And if you think that it was said by a Marxist, you're gonna raise your left fist. And if you think it was said by an anarchist, you're gonna pat your head and rub your belly. Okay?
Okay.
Go ahead and close your eyes. All right, first quote. All revolutions which have taken place up to the present have helped to perfect the state machinery, whereas it must be shattered, broken to pieces. Left fist for Marxist, head and belly for anarchist. Okay, we got a good mix. Can anybody, it's a Marxist, can anybody tell me who?
Engels.
Not Engels.
Marx.
No.
Lenin.
Lenin in State and Revolution. Arguably, by the way, the most important theorist of authoritarian socialism. Here's another quote, close your eyes. Speaking about workers' co-ops, this person says that until the social revolution has been achieved, such islands in the midst of the capitalist system can have only a limited effect. Workers should therefore, quote, think more of strikes than of cooperatives. Left fist for Marxist, head and belly for anarchist. Okay, you can open your eyes. That was by two anarchists. It was a paraphrase by Daniel Guérin, who is a French anti-fascist during the 20th century, and he was paraphrasing that quote at the end was from Bakunin, a Russian revolutionary and arguably one of the most important founders of anarchist thought. We're going to do one more quote, and then I promise we'll be done. Close your eyes. If I can't dance to it, it's not my revolution. All right, as much as I wish this was by a Marxist, it is in fact by famous Jewish-American anarchist Emma Goldman, and is, by the way, the most anarchist thing I've ever heard. So, I promise the game is over, but it's worth noting that I could go on. Guérin writes elsewhere that, quote, the anarchists are not so naive to dream that all remnants of the state would disappear overnight, even though this is actually a common Leninist critique of anarchism. Likewise, Marx writes in The Poverty of Philosophy, quote, does this mean that after the fall of the old society, there will be a new class domination culminating in a new political power? No. The working class, in the course of its development, will substitute for the old civil society an association which will exclude classes and their antagonism, and there will be no more political power. Now, when compared to the anarchist call during the First International for, quote, a state which is no more than a federation of various groups of workers, end quote, it's kind of hard to say what the concrete disagreements are at play between the Marxist and anarchist visions of a revolutionary society. Now, I went back and forth about whether to do that exercise because my goal here is not for people to leave this talk thinking that Marxism and anarchism are simply the same thing. Actually, on the contrary, my goal here is to give a critique, a Marxist critique of not just this or that current of anarchism, but really the heart that undergirds all anarchist currents. But the problem is that this goal isn't helped by an exaggerated view of what the differences are, and I'm gonna spend a lot of time in this talk actually trying to clarify what, in concrete terms, the disagreements are and are not. On one foot, the argument is typically characterized like this. Marxists believe that after a socialist revolution, the working class will need to destroy the capitalist state and replace it with a worker state until such a time as class antagonisms have evaporated and the state will wither away. Meanwhile, anarchists are, you know, ideologically opposed to the state in any form, and so they think that you must go straight from revolution into a stateless society. But I think as the quotes from our game show and the quotes that I've shared since then, the lines of debate are a lot blurrier than this. And I think even though the disagreements between Marxists and anarchists have been quite fierce and in fact violent over the decades, I think it's quite difficult in retrospect to reconstruct the differing theoretical principles that underlie these debates, right? Oftentimes when we look back at these very antagonistic debates, the thinkers appear to be saying the exact same thing. And that's what I think these quotes show, and I think from this view it becomes unsurprising that, you know, the closest we have come since the Russian Revolution to actually workers seizing power and running society for themselves is in anarchist Spain in 1936. So I'm gonna go through some of the standard Marxist critiques of anarchism and talk about what historical experience has to tell us about those. The first is most commonly referred to Marxist critique of anarchism, which is the one that I've been talking about thus far, is stated by Lenin in State and Revolution. I'm gonna quote at length here, so bear with me. We do not, after all, differ with the anarchists on the question of the abolition of the state as the aim. We maintain that to achieve this aim, we must temporarily make use of the instruments, resources, and methods of state power against the exploiters, just as the temporary dictatorship of the oppressed class is necessary for the abolition of classes. He goes on to quote Marx, after overthrowing the yoke of the capitalists, should the workers lay down their arms or use them against the capitalists in order to crush their resistance? But what is the systematic use of arms by one class against another if not a transient form of state? End quote. The idea here is actually pretty simple. After a revolution, the capitalists are going to fight back, and workers have to organize themselves and arm themselves so that they can defend the revolution, right? And The problem with the disagreement here is that in practice, all Marxists and anarchists have both in practice done this, right? And they've both organized themselves, armed themselves to fight back against the capitalists. And once you're doing that, I think Marx argues here, you know, for Marxists, the state just means an armed body, which is a tool of one class to oppress another. And as soon as you have that in the Marxist definition, then you have a state. So when we compare this formulation to the historical experience of anarchism, they're not so different. During arguably the world's first experiment with anarchist power in 1918 Ukraine, the autonomous region organized by Father Nestor Makhno organized an impressive militia to defend itself against the warring countries in World War I and to keep itself autonomous against the Bolsheviks and to help with the expropriation of landlords. And in revolutionary Spain, also, the anarchists didn't only play a significant role in fighting back against fascist counter-revolution, they actually armed most of that the anti-fascist forces by converting all number of factories in Catalonia into arms factories. Maybe there's a disagreement here, as to the degree of centralization in the repression of the old ruling class, but the need for the repressive state is actually not a point of divergence between these two traditions in practice. And that I'm going to keep emphasizing that is in practice, right? There's obviously an element of truth to the disagreement. Certainly, anarchists have argued for a long time against the need for a worker state, but in practice, I think they have they've done exactly that. So what are some of the other critiques? There's a disagreement on the question of the party. Marxists have argued since Marx that working class people need a party of our own to struggle for socialism, whereas Bakunin critiqued, quote, all parties without exception. Lenin lists two additional disagreements in State and Revolution with the anarchists. First, that Marxists recognize that after, sorry, this is a quote, Marxists recognize that after the proletariat has won political power, it must completely destroy the old state machinery and replace it by a new one consisting of an organization of the armed workers. Anarchists, while insisting on the destruction of the state machine, have a very vague idea of what the proletariat will put in its place and how it will use its revolutionary power. End quote. This I think this sounds similar to the first disagreement. It's actually slightly different, I think. The point here is that for anarchists, the next steps after the initial formation of councils and these kinds of things becomes unclear because, as you saw in Spain, what happens is a situation of dual power, and it becomes difficult to resolve because essentially the anarchists are afraid the way I would characterize it, the anarchists are afraid that what's operating as a workers' government in practice will become a workers' government in name. And then the final critique is a more simple one, that Marxists demand that the proletariat, another quote from Lenin, demand that the proletariat be trained for revolution by utilizing the present state, and the anarchists reject this. I'm limited on time, so I'm not going to be able to do justice to the history of the Spanish Revolution. I'm going to use the Spanish Revolution as sort of my case study for examining all these critiques, but there is a talk later today on the Spanish Revolution, which I think is exciting because it's a piece of history that our tradition really needs to grapple with. Brief history of the Spanish Revolution. In July of 1936, after years of political turmoil and general strikes and growing working class radicalism in Spain, a fascist coup was launched by Francisco Franco. And in response, the CNT, which is an anarcho-syndicalist trade union with particular support in Catalonia, declared a general strike. And in Barcelona, they stormed a military barracks, they seized government arms and erected barricades and actually fought back the fascist coup, right? So first in Barcelona and then in the coming months in cities and towns across Spain, a social revolution happened. Workers took over their factories in massive numbers, and even more so than happened, thank you, in the Russian Revolution, peasants took over the land and began running their local communities with juntas, or basically community councils. And the country, or at least the portions of the country that at any given moment were not under fascist rule, was so thoroughly gripped by a situation of dual power that President Luis Companys even offered to step down at one point to dismantle the liberal bourgeois government and hand over power to the anarchist councils. The anarchists refused, claiming that this would be, in effect, to take state power, which they were opposed to. And they ended up instead creating a popular front government between bourgeois liberals, socialists of a number of stripes, including both Stalinist and anti-Stalinist variants, and the anarchists. And this was a disaster for the revolution. The bourgeois government argued against the continued seizures of property and of workplaces, and the Stalinists, who were armed directly by the government of the USSR, waged a brutal counter-revolution against the anarchists while simultaneously carrying on the fight against fascism. There were massacres in the countryside where Stalinists were massacring peasants who were organized into las juntas. The result was disastrous. The fascists, with aid from Germany and Italy, won the civil war and stayed in power until the handover of power to the monarchy in 1975. So we're gonna, there's my brief history of the Spanish Revolution. We're gonna return to our critiques. First, anarchists reject political parties. Kind of true. In this one case in history in which anarchism was able to motivate a social revolution, anarchists of the dominant tradition were organized into a secretive organization called the FAI, which had the explicit goal of agitating within the CNT for revolutionary politics. In fact, I think it actually quite well carried out what Lenin called for the Vanguard Party to be doing, right? That was its entire goal, is enter the working class movement, argue for radical politics, and it did just that. Second and third, anarchists did not have an ideologically consistent way of transitioning into power, and do not use the bourgeois political apparatus leading up to that point. And again, it's true to an extent, but even this supposed principle of anarchist revolutionary theory was, to another extent, actually forsaken in practice. So even as the CNT was rejecting state power, they then turned around, joined, they had five seats out of 12 on a defense council, basically a cabinet to the liberal bourgeois government. The government would go on to play just as counter-revolutionary of a role as the Republic had before, only this time with anarchist cover. The point here is that while the CNT failed to seize power at the decisive moment, they still actually did participate in the very state structures that they were so critical of. So I contend that apart from the historical strategic failure, this is the hot take portion of my talk. Until that failure, the anarchist organizational principle as applied to the transition to socialism is actually quite simple. It is just all power to the Soviets. American anarcho-syndicalist G.P. Maximoff acknowledges this when he's talking about 1917, and he says, quote, "The Bolsheviks had not only abandoned the theory of the gradual withering away of the state, but Marxist ideology in general, they had become some kind of anarchists," end quote. And I think the Spanish anarchists acted this out when, despite their later betrayal, when the decisive moment came in the Spanish, for the Spanish Revolution, they created the councils that that Marxists would argue to be created, and they created them with the explicit acknowledgement that those councils would go on to be the governing bodies of a socialist society. All anti-party and anti-authoritarian prejudices aside, in practice, anarchists have, at least at their most successful moments, carried out in practice the construction of a revolutionary workers' government. So I think you can walk away from this point again saying, well, what's the point of being a Marxist or an anarchist? In practice, they end up being the same thing. And I also want to push against that. British Marxist Duncan Hallis writes of libertarian socialism, which is anarchism, in Party and Class, quote, "Much libertarian thinking proceeds from very general ideas about the evils of formal organization to highly specific conclusions without much effort to investigate the actual course of events. A few general notions, a few supposed truths, which are easily mastered in half an hour, become the substitute for serious theoretical equipment." Now, I'm not going to argue it in such a polemical fashion, but I think Hallis is actually really on to something in this passage. So how much time do I have?
You're at 15, right?
I'm at 15. Okay, perfect. I think I have time for quotes. I'm gonna throw a bunch of quotes out that I think demonstrate this point, and then we'll deconstruct this. So these are from a range of anarchist thinkers from across the tradition's history. Quote, "Anarchism can be described first and foremost as a visceral revolt." Quote, "Anarchism does not see itself as fundamentally a project of analysis. It is more a moral project." Quote, "The liberty of man consists solely in this, that he obeys the laws of nature because he has himself recognized them as such, and not because they have been imposed upon him externally by any foreign will whatsoever, human or divine, collective or individual." Visceral revolt, moral project, laws of nature. So I've tried to sketch out in this talk how much of the debate between Marxism and anarchism actually resolves itself in the crucible of struggle, and that despite libertarian sloganeering on the part of anarchists, they have at crucial moments been willing to step up to the plate and carry out, at least inconsistently, the seizure of power. I've tried to give you the standard answers, right? What Marxists will typically say, the standard Marxist critiques of anarchism. And I've also shown how, in practice, the anarchist tradition has a lot more in common, I think, with respect to the organizational forms needed to transition to socialism than one might think. But it's on this question of idealism versus materialism, and this is what I'm going to spend the rest of my time talking about, that I think the disagreement seems more profound. Anarchist anthropologist David Graeber writes, quote, "Many have complained that anarchism lacks high theory. Even those who are considered to be its founding figures seem more pamphleteers and moralists than true philosophers. And the best known anarchists of more recent times have been more likely to produce witty slogans, wild poetic rants, or science fiction novels than sophisticated political economy or dialectical analysis." Again, this is from an anarchist. This is not just me shitting on anarchists. I think anarchism appears to us as a set of negations and slogans, or what I want to call political morals, because that's precisely what is at its core. Anarchism, at its formation, adopted much of what would become the socialist movement's politics, but also, as Rudolf Rocker shows, again, an anarchist, it combined this anti-capitalism with significant influence from classical liberalism, which, you know, it maintained highly individualist understandings of things like rights and liberty, the relationship between people and the state. And for those of you who are more familiar with the anarchist tradition, it combined Proudhon with Stirner, right? And I think that has left anarchism with an idealist streak that has been really the determining factor in its distinction from Marxism. For Marxists, socialism is the historical objective of the working class. It is, of course, a vision of a better society, right? Freer, more liberated, more just. But it is a vision that we create through the process of concrete struggle. In Tony Clift's words, quote, another British Marxist, quote, the role of Marxists is to generalize the living, evolving experience of the class struggle, to give a conscious expression to the instinctive drive of the working class to reorganize society on a socialist basis. The working class struggles for socialism, and we give it a name. For anarchists, politics is an attempt, I think, to actualize an ideal. And its methods then become more focused on the actualization of its political morals. It becomes anti-authoritarian, these morals include anti-authoritarianism and individualism, iconoclasm, I think, especially with respect to organizations, and sort of a righteous, violent rejection of society. It becomes more about actualizing these morals than the more contingent and strategic outlook of Marxists in the fight for socialism, which I think Marxism puts the power question at the center of that. Anarchists construct the state, they talk about the state as an inhuman evil, which is kind of outside society and imposed on society from nowhere almost, whereas Marxists talk about the state as a concrete tool of the ruling class, right? And I think if and when anarchists are able to embrace tactics, thank you, I'll wrap up here in just a minute, that put the working class in the driver's seat, they end up being forced to stray from the ideals that are at the center of their political theory. So I think this is the Marxist critique of anarchism proper, right? I think our two political traditions, we share common goals, we share common histories and languages and analyses and sometimes even strategies. But where we diverge is on this fundamental question of idealism versus materialism, of how we conceive of our political project. And Marxism sees itself, at least, and I think is, a scientific project, whereas anarchism is a polemical one. I think while anarchism can, in the right conditions, be an effective political force, its idealism, which is precisely the thing that sets it apart from Marxism, ends up being more a barrier to its ability to succeed than an actual thing which helps it. So thank you. I'm going to hand it over to Amanda, who's going to talk more about how this analysis now plays out in the movement today.
Hey, comrades. I'm Amanda from Boston. I wanted talk about how some of these politics apply to our organizing today. Like Jonas said, Marxists and anarchists, we want the same thing. We want human liberation. We want a world free of exploitation and oppression. And we all take that fight very seriously, so I think it is important to debate out strategies for how to get there. Over the past several years, we've been talking about it throughout this conference, we've seen a massive radicalization taking place, and in 2011, a year that was marked by a massive struggle inspired by the Arab Spring, anarchist politics dominated really the political trends that emerged throughout that year. So you had the movement of the squares in Portugal and Spain and Greece, you know, the Occupy movement here in the United States, where people took over public spaces, drawing attention to corporate greed, inequality. And then from there, the radicalization has only grown. And just looking at the election, the 2016 election, I think it reflected both the polarization, increased polarization, and also the growth of radical left-wing ideas, particularly with the Bernie Sanders campaign. I just want to say I don't think that anarchist politics are dominating the radicalization right now, but I do think that they're still important to talk about, and they still are part of the radicalization. I want to talk a bit about, confronting the far right, defeating the far right as a main example to go through to talk about some of these differences, and also talk about methods of organizing. Okay. This is a... Jonah spoke a little bit to this in terms of... It's hard to describe... It's not like if you identify as an anarchist, then you know it, I know exactly what all your politics are. There's so many different trends amongst anarchists. Engels once described anarchists as, quote, so unique that no two of them can agree with each other, end quote. And I think it's still true today. And so these ideas express themselves in so many different ways, from consensus-based decision-making models, activist collectives, spoke councils, affinity groups, black bloc tactics at demonstrations, targeted at property destruction, smashing windows, Starbucks, etc. There are anarchists that oppose all forms of organization as tyranny, some who hold politics very close to Marxists, and some that embrace lifestyle choices, such as being a vegetarian or living in a cooperative. And others who advocate for the propaganda of the deed, the idea that individual acts of terrorism can spark a wider rebellion, wake up the masses. And so, yeah, I'll focus on some of the debates amongst the left on confronting the far right and some of the trends within Antifa. That's been a large experience for me in Boston in the past year. And so, yeah, definitely, they're very relevant. So since Donald Trump's election, we've seen a huge emboldenment of the far right, them taking a more aggressive, violent approach than they have in the past 30 years. Hate crimes targeting Muslims, Jews, African Americans, LGBT people have really spiked across the country. And we've seen examples of extreme violence, like a white supremacist carrying out a stabbing in Portland, Oregon, of three men who were defending two Muslim women from harassment. And
can you speak up a little?
They've organized rallies in cities and rural communities across the country, and I'm sure we all know that one of their rallies in Charlottesville last summer, hundreds of people showed up with lit tiki torches, and they were chanting, "Jews will not replace us," and other violent racist chants. And the next day, when counter-protesters came out to their main rally, one of their members actually drove into protesters, murdering one of our comrades, Heather Heyer, and injuring others, showing the world what they truly stand for, not free speech, but hate and violence. And this has been, the struggle to confront the far right has been so significant since the election of Donald Trump, and it's brought together a lot of leftists, socialists, and anarchists who've played significant roles in leading the struggle. I think anarchists and socialists, we have a lot in common where we do want to confront, we do want to defeat the far right. We don't claim to, that just ignoring them will make them go away. But there are differences in strategy and tactics that are connected to some of what Jonah laid out in terms of the differences of idealism and materialism. there's been a ton of examples of counter-protesting the far right, from Portland to Berkeley to Charlottesville. We've had some victories, we've had some defeats, and you know, we're really in the process of developing and strengthening an anti-fascist movement. So, just think it's important that we talk about how to do that. And there are anarchists who, you know, within Antifa groups that look to secretive organizing, street fighting tactics. And when our organizing is secretive, it really prohibits the left to connect with people outside of us. It limits the democracy within our movement to figure out a way forward. Street tactics are not enough to stop the far right. The far right isn't, the growth of the far right isn't the result of just American backward ideas or the, you know, tendency for racism. What we're seeing is really an international phenomenon. We're seeing this in Greece, Britain, Germany, France, etc. The growth of the far right is a consequence of an economic crisis that's really driven down working class living standards while making the rich wealthier than ever. The political establishment has offered no answer to this crisis, and so really the left must seek to educate a new generation of people about the need to challenge the far right through mass mobilization, which includes, you know, education about struggles of the past, for example, fighting fascism in Germany, as well as debates and discussions about strategy and tactics in the here and now. And this means, you know, really attempting to mobilize the largest possible response anywhere and everywhere the far right tries to mobilize. It's not possible for a minority of people to defeat fascists. It's not just a group of people with bad ideas, though that is certainly true. And we want to demoralize them and make them afraid to organize, but it's also about the underlying material conditions that give rise to these ideas, which have to be taken up in an anti-fascist movement. And we need the masses to both defeat the far right as well as the conditions that give rise to fascism. In Boston, we've worked to mobilize people outside of the left. It's not always easy, but we there's massive amounts of people who oppose Nazis and want to confront the Nazis. We've built public counter demonstrations, and we've been able to see we saw one of the most important victories last August. We actually forced them through mass mobilization to cancel rallies across the country. It's really important that we fight for mass demonstrations every single time they organize. I already said. While we both agree on the need to fight the fascists, socialists insist that our strategies in that fight should be based on a long-term perspective of how the conditions for the rise of fascism can be eliminated. In the context of mass mobilization, we should be prepared to confront and defeat the fascists, but the defense of our organizations, of our movements, of our demonstrations should be a coordinated effort and democratic, and our side should be careful to distinguish between effective defense and the use of force and provocations that end up weakening our side. To the extent that the struggle is limited to self-appointed street fighters, it discourages mass participation, which is an essential condition of our success. So successful confrontations will require larger forces, higher levels of planning and organization linked closely to more substantial mobilizations. The Black Bloc self-conception as an autonomous force, acting without accountability to anyone else, and yet, on behalf of marchers to defend them, is elitist. It co-signs other participants to this role of spectators at best, because the direction of a demonstration is decided by a minority. Our side faces the question of defending itself from the police, even in mass marches. But we're in a better position to hold our ground and prevent police from dividing and attacking us if we have numbers and unity on our side, rather than groups of protesters splitting off, separating themselves, acting autonomously with diversity of tactics. So I really encourage people to bring this up in discussion. That's all I'm going to say about the differences in fighting the far right. I want to get into the way that anarchist politics play out in terms of models of organization and decision making. So when the Occupy movement emerged in 2011, consensus making was a main model of decision making. It continues to be used in left-wing circles today. There's also a resistance amongst many anarchists to organize leadership or centralism, and ultimately these questions are connected to the question of, you know, how do we win a revolution? How do we achieve a stateless classist society? Instead of democracy where the majority imposes its will, many anarchists look to consensus where, you know, everyone has to come into agreement. I think at first glance it sounds like a great way to organize. Like, we want to do something that everyone in this room agrees on. But this model has severe limitations, and it actually ends up being both elitist and impractical. This, in practice, it puts pressure on people to just go with the minority rather than stating their opposition or clarifying positions. It gives a lot of power to one person who can just come out and block any final decision that people are making. And it lays a basis for unelected leadership to develop where the loudest and most confident can rule an entire group of people regardless of their politics. This phenomenon was recognized as a feature of the early women's movement in an essay by Jo Freeman in 1970 called The Tyranny of Structurelessness. I just want to read a quote from that piece. "To strive for a structureless group is useful and deceptive as to aim at an objective news story, a value-free social science, or a free economy. A laissez-faire group is about as realistic as a laissez-faire society. The idea becomes a smokescreen for the strong or the lucky to establish unquestioned hegemony over others. This hegemony can be easily established because the idea of structurelessness does not prevent the formation of informal structures, but only formal ones." End quote. This model of organizing is connected to the way that many anarchists attempt to prefigure future classist stateless society and fighting for a society based on free association, without coercion, without bureaucratic centralism. Many anarchists believe that models of organization today must also have these characteristics. The idea that we can prefigure the future society plays out in anarchist circles in different ways, whether it's consensus model making decisions, or living in a collective with your anarchist friends, or creating affinity groups, which are organized in a non-hierarchical and autonomous way. There's this idea that there should be no leaders and everyone should have an equal voice and responsibility. But this ends up mostly being a focus on how you live your life rather than how do you actually strengthen struggle, build a movement, win. And these ways of organizing are also connected to a common anarchist idea of opposing all authority on principle. And what we say is socialist in terms of leadership, you know, we're not opposed to all authority on principle. Political leadership is inevitable on our side in activist circles. The question is whether it can be held accountable to a larger group, which is why elections are important. Okay, great, thank you. I think hostility to leadership and authority is a healthy instinct given our experience in capitalism every day, where a vast majority of our experiences with leadership and authority are oppressive and full of betrayal. However, leadership within the working class movement should be seen as distinct from ruling class leadership. Leaders in the working class leaders in working class struggle are not appointed from above. They're people who are actually leading in struggle in your workplace, in your campus, in your community. And it matters that we have democratic structures to formalize such leadership when possible. Furthermore, denouncing leadership doesn't solve the problem of leadership in the working class movement. Just denouncing leadership really means you leave it up to the reformists. Far from an outright rejection of all forms of leadership, the left needs to fight for political leadership in our movements, in our workplaces, and in our campuses. And the way that we can win leadership is to working to persuade to win people over who are, you know, also working to win people over to a revolutionary perspective. In order to do that, you must organize, work to bring people together. You know, and that's, you know, we think that's good. Like leadership can be, leadership can be a really good thing. As socialists, we say you can't equate the authority of a mass workers' movement attempting to change society and to end violence and oppression with that of the ruling class. You know, the authority of a workers' committee is much different from that of, you know, say, a cop or your boss. And I'll just wrap up by saying, you know, what we say about working class leadership, I think it brings us to a major point of debate among socialists and anarchists that Jonah really went through, which is anarchists and socialists, we agree that the state needs to be smashed on the road to a classless, stateless society. However, we disagree on what's next. And because anarchists reject the state on principle, though Jonah laid out some examples where it didn't in practice look like that, socialists think that a worker state is necessary in order to completely defeat capitalism and transition to the society we're fighting for. It's first and foremost necessary for, you know, a period of defense against counter-revolutionary forces, which will and have always fought to, like, hell to defeat our movements. In a worker state or the dictatorship of the proletariat, it's not anti-democratic, it's actually the complete opposite. It's a body democratically tied to working class revolutionary movement that acts on behalf of the majority, which is, you know, different than a ruling class state which acts in the interests of a minority. While the question of revolution is not on the table for us today, these debates do have tomorrow. These debates have implications for future struggles. It is important for radicals and revolutionaries to take up these questions now, and these debates matter for how our struggles can advance and move forward. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.